Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Maher, and I'll be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Hinckley Institute strives to teach students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers internships to students of all majors here locally in D.C. and in 35 nations around the globe. Hinckley also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is, Does the Bystander Foster Extremism? Our guest is Amos Guerra. Amos Guerra is a professor of law and co-director of the Center of Global Justice at the S. J. Quinley College of Law here at the University of Utah. He is also a member of the National Security Advisory Committee, a research associate at the University of Oxford, and a research fellow at the International Institute on Counterterrorism. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Can you hear me? All right. So good afternoon, and thanks for coming. So by now, the title has pretty much changed to an inquiry into complicity. Does the bystander foster extremism? And if I do this correctly, we'll see. The point of the discussion will be to focus on the question of complicity. But before getting into the substance of it, I have to explain how I got to this. I got to this topic probably on a personal level because my father was on a death march in November of 1944. Of the 10,000 people on his death march, 100 survived. And so I was raised knowing about death marches, but not knowing anything about death marches. But it's obviously been, in many ways, an important part of who I am, with the problem of not knowing anything about it. But I asked myself this complicated question, I think, of which there is no clear answer, whether or not the bystander, the person who's complicit to some extent, does his or her decision not to act, does that cause, lead to extremism? So in focusing on the death marches from November 1944 to April 1945, what's important to note is in that time period, in those 6-7 months, World War II was clearly all but over. It was clear that Germany was going to lose the war. The Russians, or the Soviets as they were called at the time, were coming from the east. The good guys were coming from the west. And Russia and Germany was, you know, stuck there in the middle. And in spite of that, in that six-month period, there were a significant number of death marches, which we'll get into. But, and here's the important but, I think it's really important in undertaking this project that I also have to look at the history leading up to the Second World War. It's not enough to start in November of 1944. And it's important to take a long look at what led to the Second World War and what was the state of Germany at the time. So obviously there's a disclaimer. As you correctly said, I'm a professor of law. I'm not a professor of history. I'm not a social anthropologist. I'm not a cultural anthropologist. I'm not a psychologist. At the end of the day, I'm just a law professor who's intrigued by the question of complicity. But in looking at the historical background, there are obviously a significant number of events that occurred well before 44 that clearly impacted what happened in the death marches and what happened in the Holocaust. And in the context of writing this book, which I, frank, full disclosure, have not yet started to write, I'm still at the research stage, I'm reading eclectically, trying to understand Germany at the time. So, quick historical review, World War I ends, Treaty of Versailles, the Germans clearly feel because of the reparations that are imposed on them that they are not only the losers in the battlefield, but they are the losers moving forward because of how the Allies have treated them, which leads, obviously, to the financial collapse of Germany and then Hitler's rise to power, the Nazi Party, the National Socialist Party. And there was clearly, and the readings indicate this pretty concisely and precisely, that there was extraordinary dissatisfaction with the previous regime, and perhaps most importantly of all, the sense that the National Socialists, the Nazis, were replacing this extraordinary disorder with order. And that word order is important when we come full circle in terms of examining the question of complicity. But there was this sense, it's clear in the literature, that this, no other way to put it, restoration of order was essential to understanding Germany post-World War I. So I don't know how many of you are psychologists or are studying psychology, but the question of the relationship between the bystander and the victim is really important. Question number one is, who's the victim? So I was raised in the tradition that the people in the death march were the victim, and that the person, the bystander, was to some extent perhaps, responsible for their ultimate demise. But in asking who's the victim, it's really important to also examine that question from the perspective of the bystander. And full disclosure, I have come to the conclusion that in order to answer this question honestly, I have to do something that for me is difficult, and that's to take one step back, because it'd be easy for me to do, you know, accuse and to say that the bystander is guilty. But in the name of intellectual honesty, I have decided that as difficult as it is to force myself to look at the question of the bystander through the shoes of the bystander. Not only through the shoes of the person on the death march or the death marches, but also to examine the milieu and the circumstances of the bystander. And in order to do that, that obviously requires looking at exactly these three things: the cultural norms, societal norms, and historical context. And in the historical context, here we are again, that magical period of November 44 to April 45, the bystander's world has come to an end. Whether it's in Dresden, after the Allies have bombed Dresden, after they've destroyed Dresden, after God knows how many German soldiers have been killed in the war, after there's clear difficulties in Germany day in, day out, and last but not least, or perhaps maybe most importantly of it all, from the perspective of the bystander, what is called the dehumanizing of the Jews in the Holocaust, that perhaps what I perceive to be the victim, from the bystander's perspective, was receiving his just deserts. And if you view it from the perspective of receiving his just deserts, then perhaps the victim is not a victim, but the victim is somebody who actually was guilty of contributing one way or another to the situation in Germany. And in that sense, it really is important, and I'm forcing myself in all the readings I'm doing, to ask whether or not the bystander's actions are automatically to be viewed as quote-unquote complicit and quote-unquote guilty, or whether or not there are extenuating circumstances that justify their inactivity. I must add in parentheses that because I've yet to begin writing, though I'm doing a lot of research, what I really request after I finish the talk is the more questions, the better, and you know, the more dialogue there is will help me enormously. So the question of the Jews in Nazi Germany. Obviously, the Nuremberg Laws codified the Jews are the enemy of the state, and I mean, obviously, right, that throughout the course of German history, there's been institutionalized anti-Semitism. And what runs through literature clearly is that this idea that the Jew is the enemy penetrating German society. But it's not only in the context of the individual who perhaps sees the Jew as the enemy, but what's clear is the sense that institutions, bad English, but institutions have institutionalized this anti-Semitism, and therefore the enemy, the Jew, must be punished. And if you go back to the picture with which we begin, the death march itself, the question really is whether or not the person who stood there and watched this death march, saw these people walking, and we'll get into numbers of death marches, whether or not the person walking was an innocent civilian, or whether or not the person walking was an enemy. And if the person is an enemy, then perhaps that justifies not offering them any assistance, because you don't necessarily offer assistance to an enemy, though that's obviously a question mark. But the idea of viewing the Jew as the enemy, I think, is absolutely essential to understanding the perception of the bystander. So in the context of those 6 months or 7 months, so on the death march that my father was on, it was a death march that starts in Yugoslavia and breaks down or they're ambushed as they're coming to Hungary. But the larger question is, what's the state of German society at the time? Again, in the context of viewing this through the lens of the bystander and asking the question of complicity, and if German society is breaking down, is it reasonable to expect the typical German civilian citizen to do anything but to try to save their own skin? Is it reasonable to ask somebody if his own life is potentially endangered because of the Allies are coming from the East and the West simultaneously? Is it reasonable to impose on them the burden or the duty to assist the other? That's one of the fundamental questions in this entire conversation, and on that I really do need help. In that same time period is exactly when the evacuation of the concentration camps begins. So going back to my dad's march, the camp that he was in was in Yugoslavia. It was an evacuation of 10,000 people on his death, on his in his camp. So they're evacuated. And in many of these marches, what's pretty clear from the literature is what is called the March to Nowhere. And many of these marches are just walking in these huge circles day after day, mile after mile. Some townspeople... Shit, what did I do? Oh, does it come back magically? It really is a good PowerPoint. All help appreciated. Oh, thank you.
Just have to hit the view mode now.
All right. Modern technology. Can you guys read that? Oh, look at that. All right. So, in many of these marches, some townspeople have very clearly stated that they saw the same people over and over again because these really were the marches to nowhere. So we found, Griffin, my research assistant, has found maps of the death marches. And many of them are in the same particular geographical area, and simply a sense, again, there's no other term for it, but of marching to nowhere. And the reason that they were marching to nowhere is the following. German society had broken down. German society was decentralized. And many of the death marches, the commanders of the death marches were officers, not even officers, were NCOs, non-commissioned officers, at the rank of a sergeant. I don't know how many of you served in the military, but there were no officers because many German officers were trying to save their own skin. They had, you know, disappeared. They were trying to, you know, reintegrate into civilian life. And on a significant number of death marches, the most senior person is a sergeant. And the reason that there's a sergeant is because, A, the officer corps had evaporated, and B, there was clearly no specific order from Himmler and others as what to do once the concentration camps were evacuated. So there's a two-part process here, right, ultimately leading to the bystander and the death marches. One is the closing down or the evacuation of the concentration camps. And two, a sense of where to go with nowhere clear to go. And the maps that we have found simply show this constant, right, circling, constant walking in a circle with no clear destination whatsoever. The most famous march, arguably, is after Dachau was closed in March of 45. And again, this constant walking, people dying either by natural causes or people being gunned down. At the end of the day, 250,000 people were killed in the death marches. But what's also, now working our either way backward or forward, depends how you look at it, is how many concentration camps there were. When I was raised as a child of Holocaust survivors, I thought there were a small number, you know, Auschwitz, Treblinka, and the other famous ones. But look at the sheer numbers. 600 confirmed concentration camps in Germany. That's extraordinary. I mean, that's a mind-boggling number. And altogether, over plus minus 15,000 concentration camps all in all. That tells me the following in the context of the bystander. This is the point made by Donald, by Goldhagen in his book, Hitler's Willing Executioners. It is impossible for anyone living at the time to say, I did not know. They cannot say, I did not know, but the question is, it's not enough to say, I did not know. The intellectual question in the context of complicity is, could I have done something? So it's a two-step process. One, the numbers speak for themselves. I mean, this is absolutely an extraordinary number of 15,000 concentration camps. So that eradicates any concept, I think, in terms of intellectual honesty from the perspective of the people living at the time, to say that they were ignorant, they didn't know. But the second question, which goes to the essence of the project, is the fact that you obviously knew. Does that make you complicit in what happened? And that to answer that question requires answering a two-part question. One, what are the limits of individual accountability? And what are the limits of individual action? I found 59 different death marches, though I assume the more we get into it, the more we'll find. And ultimately, as I say, 250,000 people killed in the context of the death march. What's critical, and the pictures are pretty clear here, walking through the center of town. And and the pictures not only show people walking through the center of town, but the pictures clearly show townspeople watching the people on the death marches walking through the center of town. I mean, it's as clear as the day is long. But again, I have to be careful here. The fact that you're seeing somebody on a death march walking through the center of town, the question is, does that mean I have the duty to provide them assistance? So there's a three-part relationship here. There's the bystander. There's obviously the victim, however we define the victim and whoever we define as the victim. And then the guard. I have found some testimonies of bystanders offering or seeking to offer assistance to the victims. In some cases, they were warned by the guards not to do so. And in other cases, the guards didn't do anything. Some of the testimony suggests the obvious argument that if I provide assistance to the victim, something will happen to me. There, I have yet to find what I would call empirical support of that argument. The traditional argument has been if I provide assistance to a guy in a death march, ill will befall me or my family. Not necessarily correct. But in this complicated triangular relationship here, again, and I emphasize, to define who the victim is, it's important that I analyze it not only through the lens of who I perceive to be the victim, but who the bystander perceives to be the victim. And if you go back to the Nuremberg laws and so on, it may well be that from the perspective of the bystander, the victim is really not the victim, but the victim is the enemy, and he is therefore not the victim. So this obviously leads to the complicated moral and legal questions. This is in many ways the crux of the matter in terms of understanding complicity. What duty is owed? And it's a two-part question. One, what duty is owed, and to whom is a duty owed? So I work my way in terms of the cases. I don't know how many of you heard of Kitty Genovese. She's the one who was killed in New York, murdered, right? The literature, this is the 50th anniversary of her brutal murder is this year. Two books have come out suggesting that the Kitty Genovese story as we know it is actually factually incorrect. That there were not 39 people who watched her being killed that night. But there was only one guy who was actually in a position to prevent her killing. There were two who maybe saw, maybe didn't see. And the rest of those who have been perceived historically to be the bystanders didn't see it, and it's unclear what they heard. It's a really interesting question as to whether or not the New York Times, which ran the story and ran with the story, based on the report of one reporter, whether in essence the New York Times has been incorrect for the past 50 years, and there's a book that's out that's suggesting that Kitty Genovese, which has been used as the example of the bystander, is a historical, not fiction, because she was killed, the poor woman. But the facts are absolutely incorrect, and it's important to note that because one of the questions in the bystander complicity is exactly what are the facts. So laws are inconsistent here in terms of what we would call the Good Samaritan law, in terms of the duty question, in terms of the responsibility question. And I think in many ways the lack of clarity in terms of the legal question will increasingly force me to do something where I'm on shaky ground, frankly, and that's to delve more into the realm of ethics and morality, because I'm not an ethicist, I'm not a moralist, and I'm not a philosopher, but to ask myself more the moral question rather than the legal question. And when I ask myself the complicity question, to look at it more through the lens of a moral obligation rather than through the lens of a legal obligation. That said, it's important to remember what Aquinas said. Aquinas said that you have a duty to ignore what is in essence an illegal law. So that means then we have to ask ourselves from the perspective of the German populace, if the Nuremberg laws were illegal, then should they have been followed? The answer according to Aquinas is no. because obviously the Nuremberg Laws promoted evil. But there, too, the question, going back to an earlier slide, is what is the social contract at the time? What's the milieu at the time? And if you watch the Nuremberg rallies and so on, it's obvious the German population bought hook, line, and sinker into the Nuremberg Laws. Does that make them illegal? Question mark. Again, from the perspective not of us today in 2014, but in terms of the Germans at the time. In the context of the bystander, there is this thing called the diffusion of responsibility. The more people who are watching, the less people will act. I mean, the empirical studies are pretty clear about this. If you have a large gathering or a large crowd and one person falls, people will be hesitant to respond. If there's one person watching one person, he's more prone to assist. So if there are lots of people watching the marches, then few people will actually be engaged. All right, why not get involved? One, repeating, but for a reason, it's unclear who's suffering. And if it's unclear who's suffering, it's unclear to whom a duty is owed to. Two, the word here is wrong. It's not delegitimized. It's actually dehumanized the Jews. Three, question of who's the victim. And four, I cannot emphasize this strongly enough, the question of societal retribution. And the question of societal retribution is really important in the context of complicity, because if I'm going to be punished for providing assistance, then maybe I shouldn't view it through the lens of complicity, but I should view it through the lens of actually saving myself. Next, what practical assistance can I offer? Do I offer a glass of water? Do I offer food? Do I offer safe haven? What can I really do in the context of 44 to 45 when German society is breaking down? Can I really provide practical assistance? So I found some testimony by death march victims who say all they really wanted was a goddamn glass of water. That would have been sufficient. And yes, there is some testimony of people providing water. Could they have provided more? Yes. But again, working full circle, did they owe that duty? And do they owe that duty if the person is really the enemy? And that, in many ways, is the theme that recurs over and over again. In the context of the duty question, there's a direct relationship between complicity and duty. So in the perfect universe, I would stand here before you and say that we all owe a duty to a person we see in distress. And I would then add to that in the ideal world, utopia's world, saying if you see something ill befall somebody, you have the responsibility to provide aid to that person. And I'm willing to bet you, not all, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, not all of us will do that. And not all of us will do that for a variety of reasons. One, because we got to get to class. Two, because I know this person, I don't like this person. Three, because I don't want to get involved. Four, something may befall me, I may have to go testify in the police. There are a million reasons not to get involved. So the question is whether or not those reasons not to get involved at the end of the day are indicative and proof of complicity. So to answer that question, there is one more triangle here, and that's this relationship, which I'm struggling with, about between the law, social realities, or cultural realities, historical realities, and the question of morality and culture. So I stand before you and say, I don't really know how to resolve this triangle. But the more I've thought about it and the more that I read, it's clear to me that the theme needs to be what I call an inquiry into complicity. And in the context of asking the inquiry into complicity, the questions are as follows. One, is it feasible, reasonable to expect people to provide assistance? Two, how important is the culture of the time? How important is the history of the time? How important are my specific abilities? How important are, call it the overall picture? And at the end of the day, what is man's obligation to his fellow man? I said to somebody the other day about this project, what makes me uncomfortable with this project, and full disclosure, this project makes me uncomfortable, is it's looking a little bit into the dark side of man. And that is obviously disturbing. A lot of the literature that I'm reading, a lot of the philosophy I'm reading really does explore the dark side of human nature. But I think that the reason I'm intrigued with it, and as uncomfortable as I am with it, why I'm intrigued with it, I think it is important to ask that question about man's responsibility to his fellow man by looking at it through the lens of a specific horrible event, the Holocaust, then ultimately to see what lessons can be drawn from that moving forward. So, final words. We can go backwards, we can go forwards. I don't know how many of you have looked at lynchings and studied lynchings, but if you look at the pictures of the lynchings, here it is. People would go to church on Sunday, then they would drive home, pick up their kids, pick up the picnic basket, and pick up the picnic blanket. They would go, you know, to the park, wherever, and they'd sit there with Johnny and Janie, and they'd watch people being lynched. It was a socially acceptable thing to do. And one of the books that I've read about the South at the time was written by a woman whose grandfather was a lyncher. I don't know if that's an adjective or a verb. She graciously agreed that I speak with her, and I said she is a daughter of the South whose grandfather lynched people. She's outraged by her grandfather, and she writes with this passion and absolute, on the one hand, hatred for her grandfather, on the other hand, this love for her grandfather. She's all about complicity. And she, too, is asking this difficult question about what is our responsibility, but not idealistically, but realistically, subject to the historical realities of the time. So when I was 12 years old, I was told very briefly by my father about the death march he was on, and I was told this is the first and last time we'll ever have this conversation. And unfortunately, it was the first and last time we ever had that conversation because he never agreed to discuss it with me ever again. In researching this project, I found a 3-page description of the death march he was on, which is more horrific than horrific. And so here I am with this deep personal struggle, full disclosure. On the one hand, to address this issue objectively, and on the other hand, to try to close some kind of a personal circle in terms of where I come from and who I am. And finally, to ask myself, what are the lessons learned from all this? And can we really impose a duty on an individual to truly provide assistance to another with the complexity of the history of the time? Were you a victim or were you an enemy? On that note, questions, anxieties, concerns, unless I put you all to sleep. And the more questions, the better, because I'm full disclosure, I'm struggling with this thing.
And if you do have a question, please wait for the mic. And please say your full name.
Hello, I'm Noel DeNevers.
I'm
Noel DeNevers. I'm a professor emeritus of engineering. The numbers.
Can I just ask you to speak up, sir?
I'm a professor emeritus of engineering. The numbers you put on the screen for camps in Germany and Austria and Poland add up to about 900. And you say there were 15,000. There's a factor of 15
right.
That needs to be explained.
Sure. Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Poland, Hungary, camps in Hungary, camps in Yugoslavia, France, Ukraine. There are tons of camps in Ukraine.
And the big difference there is that you haven't estimated and then confirmed. The numbers you first read were confirmed, the other ones are estimated.
And if I may add to that, the most recent study that I have found, I'm always willing to be corrected, right? Suggest the 15,000, which has shocked Holocaust historians who had no idea there were that many camps in all the countries together. The number had previously been presumed to be in the low thousands. The number 15,000 has absolutely shocked serious historians of the Holocaust.
My name is Enzo Krensky. My question is, you said there are 59 death marches you've looked at so far. My question is, has there been ever any large-scale attempts by citizens to stop these death marches that you found?
No. Hang on. The death march that my father was on, I'll spare you the details, but it goes to your question, okay? There were 10,000 of them who had been... My father was in a camp called Bor, which was a work camp. Nobody died in Bor, okay? 5,000 Jews were released and told to go back to Hungary, and then they were all massacred. And my father was in the second group, and they were released or freed by Tito's freedom fighters, the partisans. So are those civilians standing by the roadside? No, those were Yugoslavian freedom fighters engaged in conflict with the Germans who, you know, thank God, knock on wood, were there that day to engage the Germans and to free my father. But in terms of civilians trying to stop it, no. In terms of civilians... Some of them seeking to provide assistance, water, and so on. That I have found testimony, but actually engaging the guards and seeking to have them stop the march, no.
Hi, I'm Jeff Dalby. So I'm kind of curious. You're talking about the society breaking down in Germany, and obviously it was not a very good place to be for anybody at the time. What is the situation like for Jewish people in Germany now?
That is a great question. So I lead a split life. This maybe it helps your to answer your question. I commute between here and Israel, right? So I wear two hats in this conversation. There are hundreds of thousands of Israelis who, until a few years ago, never went to Germany, and I'm one of those. You know, just never had any interest in going. And then 5 years ago, I got invited by the German military. I served in the Israel Defense Forces, right? So I got invited by the German military 5 years ago to come teach German soldiers about morality in armed conflict. And I remember thinking to myself, boy, how ironical is that, right? There is an increasing Jewish population in Germany today of Israelis who are moving to Germany. As far as I know, until half a year ago, I would have told you life is blissful there. The last half year, there's been a clear spike in anti-Semitism in Germany. I mean, a spike like this in the last half year of anti-Semitism in Germany, matched only by the spike of anti-Semitism in Hungary. And the Germans' anti-Semitism is based on three different things. Two of them which will make any sense to you at all. One is the younger generation of Germans is suffering what we in Israel call Israel fatigue. They're just tired of Israel. They're tired of feeling guilt for the Holocaust. And three, there's a sense of a little bit uncertainty in terms of economic situation. And, you know, there's a, right. So until half a year ago, there was minimal anti-Semitism, but there's a clear spike in the past half year of anti-Semitism, disturbing.
Hi, Britt Merrill. I have a question about, do you know how most of the death marches ultimately ended? And an estimate of survivors?
Very few. I know the 250,000 who were killed. I know that I said it, my dad's 10,000 killed, 100 survived. There were 10,000 on it, 100 survived. People died in two or three different ways. One, they were, you know, shot. Two, natural causes. I mean, people are walking, and, you know, I don't know if you've been to Europe. The cold in Europe in the winter is cold, and people are wearing, you know, concentration camp garb, right? And people were freezing to death. People were just dying. People were ill. Most of the death marches ended in a significant number of people dying. I have found testimonies of people, again, who have survived, but in most of the 59 death marches that we found, the 250,000 who died, in most of them, the majority of people died.
Hi, my name is Brittany Kidd, and I actually have a little bit of a background. So my great-grandfather died a couple years ago, and at his funeral, I found out that he was in part of the Nazi party. And my grandmother told me that he told a story of when him and his friends were walking down the street.
Where?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Sorry. The Nazis approached them and said, okay, well, would you like the honor of becoming a Nazi? And one of his friends said no and was shot immediately. And so this was, you know, when they were recruiting. So do you think the townspeople may have been scared to help people based on this? Maybe they would be shot because they were helping?
Yeah. I mean, that's a tragedy, right? There's no doubt that the Nazi regime was horrifically brutal. I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. And what the question you're asking is intriguing because it goes to the following in terms of complicity, right? To whom do I owe a duty? On the other hand, there were people who provided assistance. And the counter story to your terrible story is the following, at the risk of too much information. Not only do I have my father's death march, but my mother is in essence Anne Frank. The Anne Frank story is exactly my mother's experience, right, in Budapest. And my mother was fed every day by an elderly Catholic woman who every day would climb the stairs to where my mother was hiding with her. My mom was 12, and my mom was hiding with her mom. And so every day this woman would come up to climb the stairs and provide food for my mom and my grandmother. She did so at obvious risk of, you know, being outed and being killed. And yet she did it. So we have two schools of thought here, right? One school of thought says that there are people who are willing to defy a clear threat, to defy a clear danger,
and to put their lives on the line. And we have other people who are immediately, if you will, deterred by seeing somebody killed. There's clearly no easy answer here, right? And that's why I told you earlier, full disclosure, that I'm trying to approach this as intellectually honest as I can without, you know, doing j'accuse. If there are examples of people who were willing to be brave and do the right thing, then I find people who were immediately deterred from acting to not be compelling, but somewhere not between not compelling to not understanding it. But if I have to do some kind of a continuum, you can tell from my answer, I'm struggling in giving you some kind of a coherent answer. In the Holocaust Museum in Israel, there was something called the Avenue of the Righteous Gentiles, which is a list of Gentiles who provided assistance to Jews, right? So there were people who braved life and limb and perhaps put their own families at risk. They were clearly the minority. I think you're probably right that human instinct is, if I see something bad happening to somebody, I'm going to do the opposite of that to protect myself. Goes back to the question about the social contract and to whom is a duty owed, and there is obviously no clear answer in that one.
Hi, my name is Sabrina. I study international relations and Middle East studies. And I was curious, you mentioned before some of the reasons or potential reasons for not providing aid. And I know that a big part of the bystander effect is the notion that, you know, if you are uncertain, that sort of thought that pops up that says, well, maybe somebody else will help.
Right, correct.
How are you factoring that, or how have you factored that into your research and you're studying that notion of delegation of responsibility?
That's a great question. You want to write the book?
You can have that one.
So there's a woman named Victoria Barnett who works at the Holocaust Museum in Washington who has written the book on the bystanders called The Bystander. She's interesting. She's very interesting, and she's very important to the project. I have spoken with her. She really doesn't think that the idea of the diffusion is a viable argument. She says it's one that's made a lot, but she thinks that in terms of the bystander, she comes, let's call it from Rousseau's social contract theory, that we have a responsibility obligation to each other regardless of the circumstances. But you are right that the diffusion argument or the delegation argument is oftentimes made. Maybe this also goes to your question in terms of somebody else will, right? But the question is, if I see that no one else is, does that impose a higher duty on me? And I would suggest that the answer to that is probably yes. This is a really stupid example, really stupid. I was walking down in Sugar House on 21st and 7th, right? And I saw a woman even older than me driving, and she was in distress. And she drove on the wrong side of the road, and she ran into the curb. I mean, car went up in the curb, right? And I saw that she was, you know, obviously in distress. And I went up to her, and I said, hey, you know, are you okay? She said, well, what do you think? I said, okay. So I said, well, if you get out of your car, I'll park your car for you. So I drove the car for her. And there were two people like my age standing there, and a guy comes up to me and he says, dude, you were the dude. You were great. And I said, why was I great? He said, because you helped her. And his wife said, you really are, you're just, you know, you're the hero of the day. And I said, well, BS, where were you? Well, they watched the whole thing, right? And she said, no, we were watching you. You knew what to do. And I said, I had no greater skill set than you, and you could have also done just as much as I did. And he said, no, you had the situation under control. I said, you know, I'm going to put that in the book because that just proves the point that we're going to say somebody else will. I also have to say I was with a friend of mine who was a physician, and he did not help. And I said to him, I said, why didn't you? We've been friends forever. I said, why didn't you help? He said, you know why? Malpractice. Professor McCormick.
Wayne McCormick from the law school. And I have at least four images in mind as you talk. One, of course, is Paul Rusesabagina in Rwanda. The movie's Hotel Rwanda, if you haven't seen it, it's a must-see. The lynching pictures. I grew up in a part of the South in the 1950s, listening to preachers from the pulpit who supported the activities of the Klan. The 18,000, we think now, black sites of the CIA, And
but that's in the name of democracy.
Well, and that ties, of course, directly to Abu Ghraib, where we right. do have the photographs, right? What I tend to think of, and your last story really reinforces it for me, is that the question is not so much what is my duty to the victims, and I do believe I have a duty as an American citizen to the victims of some of our policies, but first and foremost, my duty is to who I am. Mm-hmm. And your story reflects actually you had a skill set that perhaps those others did not. You were trained as a person who can deal with an emergency. Having spent 20 years of ski patrolling, I have this similar stories of being first on the scene of an accident. And your training kicks in without even thinking about it. I think maybe it might help if you do focus on what is the bystander's duty to him or herself.
So McCormick, you'll write the second book. I mean, that, you know, full confession, McCormick and I have been friends forever, right? That's a great question, Wayne. I have not thought about it in terms of, I'm not a psychologist, what is it, inward looking, right?
You don't have to answer. No,
that's a great question. One of my hopes this summer is actually to go to the Holocaust Museum in Berlin, where there are oral testimonies, right, of bystanders, and which will have been translated or are being translated into English, to see exactly this, how they inwardly perceived it. I think that's a great question. Thank you. That was great.
Hi, it's me again, Jeff Dalby. So a friend of mine comes from Germany, and I was talking to her about her grandmother, who said that, I mean, it's hearsay at this point, but she said that the grandmother said she used to break into SS headquarters to steal food and whatnot. And I found myself thinking, you know, regardless of the situation, if I had been a Nazi at the time, that's probably the story I would say after the fact, too. So I'm curious, how widespread was the actual involvement with the party?
So, I last summer spent a week in Dresden, beginning the process of researching this and meeting with German academics. And I've heard 5 different stories 100 times, okay? Or 5 different responses. One, Professor Giora, enough has been written about the Holocaust, there's no need for another book. So I said, well, okay, interesting, okay. Response number 2 is, oh, Professor Giora, it really wasn't that bad, okay? Response number 3 is, oh, Professor Giora, my family also suffered. Response number 4 is, which was the most interesting, was from a German academic who told me that as difficult as it will be for me to write this book, I have to write this book because it's going to force the Germans to look, to your question, Wayne, it's going to, and maybe to your question about contemporary anti-Semitism, it's going to first force the Germans to look at themselves. And person number 5, she lost me very quickly because she makes the argument made by Wayne, help me out with the name of the guy who was going to come give a talk at the U last year, who's written a book about the Holocaust, that we have to understand. You have to. This goes to the social milieu, that you have to understand the actors from the perspective of the actors at the time, in terms of justifying it. Take all 5, it leaves me with a sense that this is a book I have to write. All right. I cannot thank you enough. By the way, I have one last request before I leave, because I see it's going to rain, right? You can find my name online, right? If you have questions, I'm desperately in need of help, statistics, like your interesting question. All help truly welcomed. I have not yet begun writing. I've written a lot of books. This one will be very different from any other book I've written. This will be difficult. All help appreciated. Thank you very much.